We also want to talk about which COVID tests are the most effective. So I don't know if you've had one of the nasal swabs, the ones that people say they dig real far in there, and it does not very comfortable, but effective. And then you've got the one where you sort of swab inside your mouth. It's more of a self, you do it yourself kind of thing. So there's less contact and less PPE required, and healthcare workers don't have the exposure risk. And those are the ones that, if you go to the city's website, those are mostly your options. Those are your two biggest options that you're going to find. So they, we're wondering which one is the best, which one works the best. And, I wanted to, ask our old friend, Dr. Steve Salzman. I haven't heard from you in like 4 days, and I'm sort of missing you a little bit, Dr. Steve. How you doing?
Okay, and how are you?
I'm okay. You know, so this is interesting because when you go on the city's website, it kind of leads you to the test sites and you can sign up, and there are different restrictions and different things you have to enter. And places that are busier than others too. I mean, let's face it. But then what I'm starting to hear from people, from my friends who have gone and different people who report back, they say that, okay, so you sign up for this appointment, you get your test, and some have reported they do this thing where they sort of, she said she coughed 3 times and then swabbed her mouth for 20 seconds and then sealed it all in like a little vial and then, you know, got that passed along to health workers. And the other one we'd all heard about for so long before that was this nasal swab where they dig in there and they, you know, that one has been out there. And I just wondered, is there a difference in terms of which ones are the most effective, which one's better? Do you know that?
Well, yeah, again, of course, the answer to everything, Anna, is they're not sure. But the truth is that if you ask an infectious disease expert or an epidemiologist when this first started, a nasopharyngeal swab, the one that goes through your nose up towards your brain, and the reason they were using that is because that's where sort of the virus likes to hang out and proliferate, and so that's why they took it from there. However, they've come up with tests now. There's even at-home tests, not even just swabbing your mouth, but spitting into a vial and sending it out to be looked at. And they're saying that the tests are as good using the mouth swabs and not having to use nasal swabs. They're sort of the same and potentially even better. Again, the important thing is know when and why you're getting tested, and go somewhere that's reputable. If you're looking again for the acute testing, and then sort of understanding the difference between, you know, what they're looking for when you get tested for COVID, and then the blood test when you're getting tested for antibodies. Because I think sometimes still there's a lot of confusion. What we're talking about is testing people acutely for the virus with either nose swabs or mouth swabs or even spit into a vial.
Yeah, because I guess if you can do it kind of yourself, it seems like there's less risk of exposure in like those drive-through clinics where they have to swab you, and you know there's a lot of PPE that's used. You got to put out a lot of gloves and masks and things for those healthcare workers to wear in order to do that test to protect them. If the self test is as effective and maybe a little less painful too, I guess that would be pretty meaningful moving forward.
Yeah, I think it checks a lot of boxes, and you're right. Just taking it from the healthcare perspective for a minute, using unnecessarily more PPE than ordinarily you would need to, and then when you do stuff like give somebody a throat culture or stick something into their nose, people have very strong gag reflexes. I had that done for esophageal monitoring. And so, I mean, when you talk about a real good inoculum dose, when somebody coughs that hard, I mean, you really need to be protected because then you're really, really at high risk if they're infected. So, yeah, anything that can cut down on potential exposure and maybe cost in use of PPE. And, you know, I think in the end, it's not like you're going to necessarily change any management based on what the test shows. You're still going to quarantine. We're still going to do supportive care. So, you know, nothing really changes. It's just important to have accurate information.
Well, to me, it's also about false positives. I mean, you don't want to have a false positive. I saw the story, and maybe you did too, Matt Stafford's wife, the Detroit Lions quarterback, Kelly. She came out very publicly because he was on the reserve list because he tested positive for the NFL's coronavirus testing that he went through. And then after he was tested negative again and again and again and again, and it turns out they believe he had a false positive. And her response was that it was, they had to self-isolate, and so there was the inconvenience of it. Okay, but then she said it also sort of led to her kids being bullied. She got kicked off. They got kicked off of a playground. They, you know, that she was kicked out of a grocery store. That everyone sort of had this big reaction because her husband's initial positive test was made so public by the NFL. But that, you know, it turned out to be a false positive. I just wonder how common that is.
It's not. And the other side, it would be false negative is what we see more, right, where patients come in and they get swabbed and it doesn't show anything, but it's early in the course. And if you did it 5-6 days after exposure, they test positive. Here, it's the exact opposite. And to be honest, Anna, I don't think they're angry about the COVID. I think they're angry about his play.
there might be a double thing there. Yeah, for sure. I mean, there might be a little bit of anger going around for a number of different reasons. I don't doubt that. But you're right, the false negative. More troubling, and we've even heard from health officials consistently that sometimes in the first days after it's been transmitted or after transmission, you've gotten it from somebody, you might test actually negative. It may take a few days for you to actually test positive.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why it's important to sort of know your exposures and when you were around and you know, everyone, buyer beware, testing beware. You know, you need to be very, very careful because there's just so much information and now so many tests to market, and it's become very confusing. And there's no cohesive message in many places, which just adds to the confusion.
Yeah. I'm just looking here at the list of things Dr. Nzeke has put out for the state of Illinois about what to do if you've hung out with someone who has COVID-19. And it does say you self-isolate for 2 weeks, you wait, you answer the phone because contact tracers' numbers might not be familiar to you and they may be trying to reach you for good reason. Then it says after 6 or 7 days, get a coronavirus test. It's free and there are tons of places to do it. But the quote here is you need to wait at least 6 or 7 days after your exposure to get an accurate test in many cases. It's a better chance that the test will be able to detect the virus. So that's a lot of days.
Right.
6 or 7.
Up to 30% of the people may test positive but develop symptoms 8+ days later. So yes, I think that's a very important point. That list, Anna, was very helpful about what she put out about what happens if you are around someone with COVID-19, and it talks about isolating yourself and getting tested 6 or 7 days later. And, you know, again, not having symptoms doesn't mean you aren't infectious, and it doesn't, you know, mean the test was wrong. So, you know, we'd be very, very careful and, you know, reach out and notify both healthcare providers and other people, because contact tracing is going to be very, very important. Although, you know, now you hear what happened with Matt Stafford's wife and you're like, oh my God, I don't want to tell anybody anything because you're terrified you're going to be ostracized. It's insane.
It is. And, you know, just hearing her experiences was just fascinating. She was yelled at in the grocery store, get out of here. You're killing people. You're endangering people's lives. And it turns out it was a negative test. I mean, he tested negative, and she might have known that already. I don't know. There were like 3 in a row negative tests at that point, but still sort of that, you know, that followed her, that stigma of having someone in the family. And I suppose if he was positive, they probably, for the best, you know, to take the precaution, you should stay home and self-isolate. But I don't know where she was at that point, you know, if she had already found out that it was negative 3 times in a row, which seems negative. Hey, Dr. Steve, let me ask you about this, too, because this is something else that has come up. Some of our health officials have mentioned it in the recent news conferences, including yesterday. Dr. Nzeke made a big point of this in the afternoon news conference that we carried here on WGN, the presser at like 2:30, and she said just, hey, everybody, be on the lookout because some of the symptoms are very, very, they seem like allergies even. There are like so many different, there's a range of symptoms in how this presents. And she was saying that people feel like, I just had a little sniffles, or I had, you know, a little this, and it didn't seem like I needed to get tested, or it didn't seem like I was in any risk. And then later found out that, you know, they may have spread it, I suppose, or they definitely had it.
Out of abundance of caution, I understand what they're trying to accomplish. You know, it's... This is such, if we took this discussion, Anna, that we're having, and we rewind like not even a year ago, this wouldn't even be a discussion. But the fact that we're in the midst of a pandemic and we're not, this isn't like, oh, this is a new spike, and we've never come out of the first phase. Sort of, we've been smoldering. You know, it's been a brush fire that's smoldering, and there are pockets that sort of, we get these big outbreaks, and now you have to work very hard, you know, with these mitigation strategies to contain it. But a year ago, you wouldn't think that. But now, it's different, and again, none of us have ever lived, these are absolutely ridiculous times, right? None of us have ever lived through a pandemic, and, you know, because of all of these things, and we don't have a vaccine, and, you know, our ability to control things lies in the old days of things that we're doing, essentially. It's a problem. I think you have to, you know, always assume the worst when it comes to this, and, you know, act as if you have it until it's proven you don't.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea. There's a Yale study here that says if you're healthy, most likely you'll get a fever, achiness, nasal symptoms, dry cough, and you'll feel kind of crappy. And like Dr. Nziki said, you get the sniffles or kind of allergy-like symptoms. But then they said anosmia, and I'm probably saying that wrong, the loss of sense or smell is what is it?
Anosmia.
I just thought of nose because it's smell. But that's not how it works, apparently. So it says was the most predictive symptom. Only half the people who reported losing their sense of smell tested positive, but it still was one of the first that sort of like in the early stages that people felt that most predicted that they were going to get it.
Isn't that wild? Do you remember when we first started talking about this in March, Anna? We were like, well, you know, this is a weird symptom. And all of a sudden, it wasn't so weird, but thousands and thousands of people couldn't taste or smell anything. Mm-hmm. I know, it's wild.
It was wild, because when that first came out, we were like, are you sure? Is that really a symptom? And it turns out that it's one of the most most common and predictors that you may, that you're, you know, you're on for potentially more symptoms to come. Hey, I want to ask you about that study involving kids, and then you've got something about immune system and sleep to talk about as well. Got to just mention this, because I don't know if you've been to a restaurant. Have you, Dr. Steve, where they've taken your temperature yet? Has that happened to you?
No, I haven't actually had a chance to go out to any restaurants, but they do take temperature in the gym.
Oh, yeah, I that doesn't surprise me. I went to, I guess, some of the larger restaurant groups in particular that are doing it kind of system-wide. Even if you sit outdoors, doesn't matter. They take your temperature. They do like a little no contact. This one was on the wrist. They just sort of took your temperature there and asked you a few questions about if you've been out of state or to any of the hot spots and before you got to sit down. That, you know, that's what they did. It's just, I guess, temperature and fevers are not, is not a telltale sign necessarily, because I think some of the studies have shown people never develop them. Isn't that right?
Right. We're scrambling to just sort of find the best way to at least provide an extra layer of security, but you're absolutely correct, Anna. There are, you know, more people than not are probably, this is not a good comment, but more people than not are probably going to come in if they are infected and not have fever, you know, because they're out and about. The people that have fever probably feel so crummy they don't want to do anything. The people that sort of don't know that they have it or that have mild symptoms are much more apt to probably go out, do something social, like go to a restaurant, you know? So,
it's a good point, because if you just have the sniffles or something like that, you may sort of discount it as something else. And if you're a fever, you're right. You feel pretty crappy. There is this study, and I want to ask you about this, because it's some school districts across the country are making this decision to open for younger kids because they're looking at the data on younger children and their infection rates and the risk of them spreading the disease either in class or at home. And they're finding that there is data that supports opening for kids under 10. So I've even seen some school districts, I don't know so much here in Illinois, but I've heard of other ones across the country where they're saying, okay, we'll open up the lower grades, preschool through like third grade, and not the older grades where the data seems to support something else. And I want to ask you about this because there are a ton of studies they're sort of piecing together here on kids in general of different ages. And what is it, what do we really know about that, Dr. Salzman?
So this is a very fair answer about just grossly since March till now, what have we seen? The answer is, like I always say, right, we don't know the correct answer. That's the correct answer. But it's clear that children are amongst the least affected groups, and there might be, you know, many reasons for it. I'll get into it in a second. But, you know, of course, some of them was that we closed schools down and you know, sort of quarantined children. So perhaps as they get out and they're exposed more, those numbers might change. But they're less likely to contract it, and the death rates are much lower. And when they talk about children being vectors for the virus, well, that's also unknown. However, children seem to transmit the virus less than adults do. Schools don't seem to be linked as often to sort of super spreader cases, such as bars and meat packing plants and such. And when they did do, because when I look back at some of the literature, oddly enough, it wasn't the teachers that were getting sick. It was ancillary. The highest risk group were like the bus drivers. And again, we have different, depending on who you look at, some of the European models show that they were able to open up fairly safely. Israel had a little bump in the road, but since I believe are doing better. What are the questions we need to ask? All the ones that we don't know. What age group matters for the transmission rates? What preventions actually matter? Is the prevention measures they're going to put in place to help? You know, hopefully masking, hand washing, distancing. These are all things, you know, that you hope contribute to a safe environment. Parents can't participate in the workforce as long as they need to stay home and provide child care. Yet another issue. And it's difficult, right? What do you say? If you live in a hot spot, if you have a vulnerable family member, if your child is vulnerable, has comorbid conditions, is immunocompromised, you have to be dedicated to disinfection and distancing. But when we look at their data, there's a lot of data that is positive. Only 17 children under the age of 5 have died. And they talk about this multi-system inflammatory syndrome that happens with younger kids. Sort of, they get infected, there's a reactivation of the virus of sorts, and then they become very, very ill and have multi-organ system failure. But this is very rare, thank God, and the majority of children recover from it. So, you know, and they don't know why any of this is, Anna, right? So here are some of the hypotheses. Some researchers think that the virus can't make its way into the cells of younger children like it does in adults. Others say that the children have smaller lungs and they push out fewer droplets, and that's why they don't become super spreaders. These are all nothing more than conjecture and hypotheses that have not been tested. But the other side of what, you know, your risk tolerance and what is the risk of keeping children out of that environment that's so important for development on so many levels. I'll say it now. I've said it before. I'll say it again, I'm sure. The untold cost of COVID will be devastating. And it's these things that we're going to have to live with in terms of decisions we make because we're going on very limited information.
Yeah.
So the answer is we don't know. It's a very difficult situation, and you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't here until the picture is more clear.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's so difficult to make these decisions in general. Coming up on the show, we are going to talk with someone from the Archdiocese, Justin Lombardo, about the decision from the Archdiocese to open Catholic schools and how they're going to do that and why they chose to do that, because it's, I don't think it's a wrong answer. I think a lot of parents would like to see some of their kids in, for some in-school learning if you can figure out a way to make it reasonably safe, and they think they have that plan. So we'll ask them about that coming up. Hey, I want to ask you, before I let you go here, Dr. C, about waking up in the middle of the night. This is something just through talking to friends and stuff I've heard, just through the sort of stay-at-home order and then beyond, people are sort of waking up. Maybe, I don't know if it's anxiety. I don't know what it is, but I know you study sleep and you deal with that with your patients and what the causes might be for not really getting that full night's sleep, you know, consistent sleep.
Good Lord, where do I start? Where's my music? That's how we start. But broken sleep is multiple reasons. Major life events, stress, anxiety, all are big culprits of keeping people up at night. Alcohol disrupts your REM. You have to get up to pee a lot. It might interfere with your breathing. Caffeine if you take it too late. Eating late night. Medications. Medical problems like sleep apnea. You know, you could be sleeping, but if you're sort of heavy set and have bad sleep apnea and you're getting woken up time and time again, you're never hitting that good sleep that you need to hit. And patients just struggle and languish because of it. Here's something, the exact opposite. Salzman, exercise all the time, exactly. But when you exercise, you make cortisol, which helps people stay more alert. So perhaps that's first thing in the morning and not working out right before you go to bed. And like we talk about, digital devices, right? We stay away from that light. There are studies that show that it lowers melatonin levels. Another thing that could potentially cause broken sleep. And napping. I get crazy when people take naps. You know, we don't need our bottles and take little nappies. If you sleep a good 6 to 7 hours a night and you hit that deep stage 4 sleep, that restorative sleep, you don't need naps. You know, if you get good sleep, it's the end all be all, because that's the key component, that if you fix that, it's like the key to open up the box to let all the other things start to come into play. But if your sleep is terrible, everything falls. And every single organ system in your body suffers when your sleep is crappy. Sleep is phase one. It's the end all be all. It's the first thing we fix here. And it's the first thing that most people need to fix to get on top of many chronic conditions, pain, anxiety, depression, so many.
You know, I don't really nap, but I just grab coffee, and that's, you know, I just, that helps me through the day. But something you don't need, Dr. Steve, I mean, you've got all the energy in the world and more left over. Thanks for weighing in today. It's good hearing from you.
Whatever did you mean by that? See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow. Talk to you later. Bye, Dr. Steve.